Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a show about communicating. This show is brought to you by Untangled Resolution, a private practice in relationship coaching and divorce mediation. I am your host, Batabile Mtombeni. I am a mediator and the founder and principal of Untangled Resolution, and I'm coming to you live from Harlem, USA. I'm so very glad that you have chosen to join the audience for today's show. Our topic today is difficult, sobering, even frightening, but unavoidable for anyone who loves and cares for children. I am welcoming three guests today, Bill Murray and Jessica Stevens, both adult survivors of childhood sexual molestation, and Jay Tao, otherwise known as Dr. J, a certified psychotherapist and licensed sex therapist, join me to talk about how to prepare your children in case they are approached by a sexual predator. My guests will also share ways to recognize the signs of abuse so that you can intervene and perhaps rescue a child who is being abused. Phone lines are open so that you can share your own thoughts and ask my guests questions. I hope that you find this show to be helpful. You are listening to composer Michelle Webb performing a piece called Zeynel from her album, DC Istanbul. We'll be back in just a moment. Hello, everyone. This is Batabile Mtombeni, and I'm so glad that you chose to listen to the show this afternoon and to join us. We are experiencing a little bit of technical difficulty that just popped up, so I'm going to ask that you bear with us. I am actually broadcasting to you from my cell phone right now. I usually broadcast through the computer via Skype, and we're having trouble connecting to Skype for some reason. So during one of our upcoming breaks, I'm going to try to see if I can fix that. Otherwise, if you're hearing me right now, things should be fine. Also, because of the challenges that we've been experiencing, I had not had an opportunity to open up the chat room. So for the chairman of my chat room, who I'm sure is sitting there waiting, going, scratching his head going, what's going on? Where's the chat room? I'm opening the chat room right now. I invite you all to join the chat room. And it's an opportunity for you to comment, ask questions, you know, talk back and forth with each other. And I can come in and see what questions you have. But, of course, during the show, we're going to encourage you to also call in live on the phone so that you can chat with our guests for the show. And our guests for the show today are very important. So let's get into what's going on. First, I have to say that this is The Problem is the Answer, and this show is called The Problem is the Answer, and it's brought to you by Untangled Resolutions, a private practice in relationship coaching and divorce mediation. In court, fair is what the judge says it is. In mediation, you decide what fair is. Settle your issues out of court, where you are the judge. Contact me at info at 123untangled.com or visit my website, www.123untangled.com, to learn more about my practice and about what mediation can do for you and your family. I'm especially honored to have three guests on the show today. Bill Murray is an activist, community organizer, and the founder of Los Angeles Community Policing, or LACP, a 10-year-old grassroots effort to improve relations between the police and community members in the Los Angeles area. More recently, he has founded the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, or NASCA. I will ask him in a bit about what inspired him to start the organization. I'm also joined by Jessica Stevens, who is also an activist and survivor of childhood molestation. And she, among other things, which she will tell us about, she co-hosts the blog talk radio show Community Matters with Bill and my next guest, Jay Tao, who is fondly known as Dr. J. Dr. J has been a psychotherapist and a board-certified sex therapist, or is a psychotherapist and a board-certified sex therapist, who has been in the field for nearly 15 years, and he has been in private practice for more than 10 years. He has worked with victims of childhood sexual abuse as well as sex offenders. So we're going to talk with him about the psychology of sex abuse and also about perhaps what goes on with sex offenders as well. So welcome, everybody, to the show. And I'm going to start with Bill, if I may. And Bill, I would like to ask you to give us a little bit of background about the depth of the problem. I think everyone listening understands what child molestation can do to someone and that child molestation is a serious issue, and that's why they've tuned in today. But I'm not sure that we are all aware of just how deep the issue is. What are the statistics?
Thank you very much for having all three of us. I'm really appreciative of this opportunity to share with you. They're frankly more shocking than most people in a country have any idea, and that's one of the reasons that we do what we do. We want to educate the public. So I appreciate being able to do this at the top of the show. But people will be surprised. I, of course, have scoured for the best statistics, the most reliable statistics I can get, and I update them when I find something better. But as of right now, the best estimates are between 1 in 3 and 1 in 4 girls in the country is sexually abused. And that's sexually abused. There's also other kinds of abuse, of course. The abuse that we cover includes also violent abuse, even neglect, or severe emotional abuse, and even bad bullying and so forth. But we're just going to give you the statistics that are sexual in nature because those are among the most that are tracked. And it also means that 1 in 5 to 1 in 6 boys is sexually abused. That means that there are right now 39 million Americans who have survived sexual abuse in our country, 39 million.
And you're talking about a true epidemic.
It is an epidemic. That's exactly the word that I use, and I don't think most people understand the size and scope of this. And we have other statistics we'll get into later to shore this up. But, you know, people know that it goes on, but they just don't have an idea to what degree it goes on and to how serious of a problem this is.
Wow. Well, you know, you're right. We will get into the statistics as we go along, but I want folks to get to know you a little bit better, and then I'll bring in Jay and Jessica. But you yourself are a survivor of childhood molestation. Tell us about your story.
Well, I'm a child. I'm a survivor. My abuse began at age 11, and it lasted through my high school years. So through my teenage years, basically. And it was at the hands of not one molester or two, but actually quite a few. And in some cases, I was kind of traded, or I was told one person would tell another, oh, he's susceptible, you know, so forth. So that went on too. And part of it even included a couple of weeks where I was kidnapped. And I also was the object of thousands and thousands of pornographic pictures. So this stuff that happened to me in my youth, none of which happened in my own house, and we'll get into that too, because some people are molested at home, some on the outside. For me, it was all on the outside. But, you know, I was the object of, it was all males who came on to me and molested me from the age of 11 and 12 and 13 at a summer camp, and then later through the high school years at the place that I chose to go to high school, especially the first 2 years of high school, because the last 2 years I was a little older and stronger and I could kind of fend people off better. And the way I dealt with it was when I went off to college in a completely different place. I really didn't know much about girls because I'd gone to an all-boys high school, and I went off and I drank very heavily, and I used a lot of drugs and a lot of girls. And that was, you know, my way of dealing with it in my 20s, through my 20s. Eventually
so
sobered up in about...
You were sort of self-medicating at that point.
Yeah, alcohol was my solution. I hated who I was and how I felt about the things that had happened to me and the fact that I was terrified of relationships and letting people know who I really was. And I had to hide the story of my life not only from the people around me but also, in a sense, from myself. So I drank right away alcoholically and to oblivion, and I did that until I was 30 when I recognized, fortunately, that the alcohol and the drugs themselves were a problem, and I went and got recovery from them, and through that began my journey about recovering from the child abuse.
Right, right. You know, you have given us sort of an overview of when the abuse started and who was responsible for the abuse. What, if anything, did you understand to be happening? Did you understand that something was wrong with what was going on, and were you able to talk to your parents about it?
Right. That's one of the things that you're going to find, I think, common with a lot of abuse people if you talk to enough of them. You'll find that we have very common experiences. Not all the facts of our stories are the same, obviously, but how we react to the things that happen to us, how we feel about ourselves and our fears and so forth, they're going to be very similar. And in my case, I was so young, and a lot of molested kids are so young, like me. I had no information about sex at all given to me at home, and so I didn't even know what this was. The person that first molested me was a camp counselor, so I was sent away from home to a person that I was supposed to be able to trust, and, you know, a group of people, and one of them turned out to be a molester who, when he was in charge of the swimming pool and the photography for the camp, and I was a big swimmer. So one day early on, one of the first few days after I got there, I was taking a shower after swimming, and he came over to me and he reached around my body and touched me in the groin. And for the first time, you know, that was the first touch. I had no idea what he was doing, you know. He proceeded from there to, he did let me know. The one thing I did know was there was something wrong about this. That's about it. That's the extent of what I knew, that I wasn't supposed to say anything. And over the next 4 weeks, because I was there for a month, he did a lot of early molesting of me, especially in his dark room, because that was a place where he could go and be private, close the door, you know, and people wouldn't come in. They'd see the red light on outside, and they'd think he was printing photographs or whatever. And what he was doing was he was photographing me or molesting me or both inside that dark room. And when I went home, I still had no information about sex. I had a month's worth of this experience, and I went out on the playground, really, to find out what I could about sex, because I felt that my parents weren't the appropriate people to tell. I was scared to tell them. And yes, I do. Actually, I blamed it on something that's probably inappropriate, but I blamed it on the fact that I was an adopted child. And I always felt that there was a certain kind of a distance between myself and my parents, the parents I grew up with. Even though I never questioned that they loved me, I always did feel that it was something different about us, and I attributed it to the fact that I actually came from, you know, a different set of natural parents. And that didn't really bother me. It just was a fact. And one of the things that I thought they wouldn't understand was this, what I was going through, I guess. That's, you know, looking in hindsight back to one of the reasons that, plus the fact that we absolutely never talked about this at home or anything like it at home, ever. So I didn't feel comfortable. And, you know, I should have been found out. I think today we might find that people that come in contact with kids are a little better trained. But I was tested because immediately my schooling suffered. I couldn't pay attention to class. I was a cut-up. I was angry. And I wouldn't do homework and so forth. And my sixth grade teacher, she attributed it to bad behavior and locked me in the supply room in the back of the class for most of sixth grade. So that's, again, a kind of an abuse. You know, I also was taken to counselors who tested me, and they didn't ask the right questions back then. They tested me at least two, three, four times, I remember being tested, and always the result was, well, he's very bright, Mrs. Murray. We don't know why he's having so much problem in school. He should be doing a lot better if he just applied himself, so we think it's just a matter of motivation. That was the word I remember. And I heard that over and over. So there were opportunities for the right, I guess, question to be asked or for me to feel safe enough to talk about it, but I never did. I thought it was the thing I had to hold secret inside of me until I was old enough as an adult to be able to deal with my own life by myself. And this is very common with child abuse victims. In fact, another statistic I'll throw out to you before you go on to the, our fellow guests who have a lot to offer on this, is that 2/3 to 90%, somewhere in there, and we're not sure because so many things are not reported, but somewhere between 2/3 and 90% of sexually abused victims never tell anyone. That's 39 million people, 2/3 of which at least don't tell anyone. So it's a gigantic problem. And and all people carry into their adulthood, just like I did, all the feelings and the fears and the experiences that they think, I thought, let's put it this way, I thought I had to deal with myself as an adult. In fact, I remember as a childhood that it was over, and I spent the remainder of my childhood, most of my adolescence and teenage years were spent with actually thinking, all I got to do is wait out my childhood. Someday I'll be old enough to be an adult, and no one will ever be able to tell me what to do again. So I lost my childhood, but I spent that decade with that kind of thinking.
Right. So, you know, you spend your childhood feeling that you are unable to protect yourself, unable to talk to anyone, so it's a very lonely and frightening way to spend your childhood.
Correct. It's really terrifying. Many of us think we're the only one that it happened to. We don't know. But we think we're the only one that it's happened to, or that it's very, very special that it happened to us. And no one would understand. And so we all learn, almost all of us learn, that we're supposed to keep this a secret. And the more we swallow the secret, keep it inside of ourselves, of course, the more internal damage it does. And the more that results in external ramifications. We make decisions that are horrible. We have trouble in every kind of relationship type you can think about in our adulthood. We run away from home. We try to commit suicide. We do all kinds of destructive behaviors that might not be alcohol or drugs. It could be overeating. It could be overspending money we don't have. All kinds of obsessive things, trying to feel different than we feel, than we really do feel. We want to deny how we feel. We want to change how we feel. And in my case, it meant drinking to oblivion from the beginning, because I was really, really in pain. And I took that into my adulthood, and I was willing to do anything that I could to get rid of the pain.
So, knowing that, and that you spent so much of your adolescence and into your adulthood trying to find ways to deal with it, what changed for you that allowed you to get sober and to start actually addressing what you were living with?
Well, as I say, I drank heavily from the beginning, but it didn't take too long. Maybe a couple of years into my drinking, I was already mixing drugs in, because I learned that if you added drugs into the mix of things you were doing, you didn't have to drink as much. Now, I still drank, but I became a chemist. I always use that word. From then on, I drank some, and I did some drugs, and I did whatever drugs you had, and I did whatever drugs I could find, and then I drank some more, and so forth. anything to get out of who I was. But, you know, whereas originally alcohol made me throw up and pass out and drive blind and so forth, never having any consequence, by the way. I was never caught for a DUI or any of that. There were no consequences. But I knew that I was endangering both myself and other people. And so the drugs were simply, again, a part of the solution. And these two things together, drugs and alcohol, worked until around age 30 when I realized that they themselves had become a problem and I could no longer not do them. So I went for help. Fortunately, fell in with a group of people who not only helped me with the drugs and alcohol, and this is in 1984, so I've been sober ever since, but very quickly introduced me to the concept of being as sick as your secrets, the terminology I still use today. And I knew darn well what the secret of my life was, so I started right then to share a little bit at a time the story of my life that I had done my drinking behind, really. But I was trying to reveal who Bill was a little at a time, and instead of them throwing me away, which is what I expected, and instead of it, you know, making me seem ugly to them, it did just the opposite. It drew me to them. It drew them to me, and they wanted to help, and they kept saying, you know, keep coming back. You need to share more about this tomorrow. You know, we want you to come back and so forth. So let's say I've been talking about it in a healthier environment than I, you know, a healthy environment for over 25 years, let's say, at least that. And, you know, if every time I tell the story, you know, it's a little easier to tell. It's sort of easy for me to talk about factually. I know sometimes people hear my story coming out of my mouth and it shocks them. It no longer shocks me. It's become what I have to offer somebody else, and it no longer has the power or authority over me that it did, of course, in my youth or early adulthood.
So it sounds like finding a community that was open and warm and accepting and non-judgmental was what was the key for you to be able to start to share your story and to basically break yourself out of the prison of the secrets that you had been holding on to for all that time.
That's correct, and that's why we've started the work that we're doing, and you're going to ask my fellows here some questions
right.
that are going to be pertinent to this too, but we started this work specifically because I know that there's very little offered to the adult person who's had abuse in their past, and since 2/3 to 90% of them are keeping quiet about it, and it's kept them. It's been the secret of their life that they've held on to and never told anyone. I wanted to start an organization that was specifically for that. We help, of course, we help children that are currently being abused. We help parents understand how to raise their kids and all other kinds of other things. But our primary purpose is to help those people who have held on to their stories find a safe way and a safe place, and to hear that we can talk about it. And so we're carrying the message that it's okay, no matter what happened to you, for you to be who you are today, and you need to let go of the story a little bit. And we provide a few tools like anonymity, for example, on our shows, where they can do that. They can write us anonymously. They can be in the chat room anonymously. They can call in anonymously. And we also actually are working with people, individuals, because we put our websites on our phone numbers and contact information in clear view on the websites and invite people to do so. So we are actually working with a few, we're still new, but we are working already with a few individuals who have contacted us and asked for our help. And they know by my telling my story, you know, that I know what they're talking about, you know, that they can identify with me and that I'll understand them. And that's what it really takes. And it's one person in recovery trying to help another.
Well, you know, and you've brought up a number of very important points, and I thank you for telling us your story. And, you know, first I must also say congratulations for your many years of sobriety. You know, since 1984 you said that you've been sober, clean and sober, and that is quite an accomplishment. So I must commend you on that. And then also I'd like to say that I've spoken with you before, and you said that this isn't necessarily a courageous thing for you, but for me, consider it to be a courageous thing that you have come forward and that you're sharing your story. Because considering the numbers of people who are listening right now, for example, people who are survivors who have not been able to deal with what they experienced, perhaps hearing you share as freely as you have will help them to begin that journey. We're going to take a short break, Bill, but when we come back, we're going to talk with your co-host, Jessica Stevens, about her experiences and her work in this very important area. So hold on. We're going to come back, and I'm going to bring Jessica into the show, and then we're also going to hear from Dr. Jade Tao, who is a psychotherapist, a licensed psychotherapist, and a sex therapist as well. And they will also come. He will also come in and talk about this issue from that perspective. But you are listening to Untangled Resolutions, presentation of The Problem is the Answer. Take a listen to Michelle Webb performing Istanbul from her album, DC Istanbul. We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you. Hello, folks. We're back, and I'm glad that you're here and listening to the show. As I've found out from my friend here, Bill, who is a guest on the show, who also hosts his own show on Blog Talk Radio, there have been issues with the technology over the weekend, and we're experiencing a little bit of that. I'm glad for you to hang in there with us as we are working under a little bit of pressure, but the show will go on, and we will do the best we can with what we've got. So I am here. You've been listening to composer Michelle Webb. The piece that you are listening to is actually My Brother, My Friend. It's an excerpt from My Brother, My Friend, and it's from her CD called DC Istanbul. And if you want to know more about her and her latest project, which is called King Kong, please visit www.michellewebbmusic.com. She's a really awesome musician. She actually played all of the stringed instruments that you hear on the CD, and I'm going to actually check and see whether she might have been playing all of the instruments on that CD. I can get that information, or you can get that information on her website if you're interested in who exactly is on the CD. But she's a really talented composer and musician, and I hope that you're enjoying her music. Before returning to the topic of our show, I'd like to remind you about Project Safe Surrender. On Friday, April 22nd and Saturday, April 23rd, anyone in the New York City area who has an outstanding warrant stemming from a New York City C summons can come to the Antioch Baptist Church, located at 828 Green Avenue in Brooklyn, New York, to have his or her case heard by a judge. Attendees will be given favorable consideration and the opportunity to go through the process with supportive volunteers to guide them through. For more information, please visit the Project Safe Surrender website at www.projectsafesurrender2011.org. That's www.projectsafesurrender, all one word, 2011, no spaces, .org. And there you can find contact information and more information about specifically what kinds of summonses will be heard on that day. If you want more information about Project Safe Surrender, you can listen to an archived version of the show from last week, which is titled Police in the Church, and you can hear everything you wanted to know about Project Safe Surrender from that broadcast. So I'm going to come back to the show, and I think I have my three guests here. I'm going to turn on your microphones. Let's see here who we've got. All right. Jessica, are you there? Okay. And let's see. Dr. Tao, are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful.
Can you hear me? Yes.
Yes, I can hear you. Now I think I have Jessica. Jessica, are you there?
I'm here, sweetie.
Wonderful.
Can you hear me?
Fantastic. And I can hear you just fine. And Bill, you're there?
Yeah, and we should remind people if they can't get the chat room, they can refresh their page. It'll come up now.
Ah, great. Yes, thank you, Bill, for that reminder. If you've been having trouble with the chat room, press your refresh button, and you should be able to get in. So as I said, it's a bit of a challenge today that we're having with the technology, but I love challenges, and so we're going to continue with the show, and it will be a great one because I've got these wonderful guests with me here today. Bill, you co-host two shows on Blog Talk Radio, actually. One is called Community Matters, and the other is called Stop Child Abuse Now, or SCAN, right?
That's right. The original one was devoted to the community-based policing organization that you mentioned before that has been in existence for, well, since 9/11, so we're in our 10th year, and we've had a show based on that nonprofit effort for maybe the last year and a half, 2 years, and they're the Sunday night show, two hours, actually not long after this show ends, will start at 8 o'clock East Coast time. But with the launch of the new nonprofit, we have, for the last month, been doing nighttime shows, also at 8 o'clock, hour-long shows, under the name Stop Child Abuse Now. And those shows are uniquely devoted to the new nonprofit, NAASCA, NASCA.org. And actually, tonight's show, we'll talk a lot about the child abuse issue, too. We're talking more and more about this specific issue because it is a community policing issue, too. It fits under the topic of the community policing site as well. So, yeah, NASCA.org has the show that's Monday through Friday at 8 o'clock for an hour, and Jessica is my co-host on that show. And tonight we'll do the two-hour version at 8 o'clock, and Jessica again reappears along with Dr. J and one other person who's a regular, MJ Goings, who's an emergency room nurse with a lot of experience, and she represents kind of the healthcare community.
Wonderful. Well, I'm so glad to have all of you here, and you're going to be doing double duty, I guess, today, being on my show and then having your own show. And so Jessica, who's here on the show, I'm sort of meeting you for the first time here on the air. Welcome to the show. Please tell us about yourself and about what you do and how you became involved in this, in Stop Child Abuse Now and also with NASCA.
Well, I want to thank you first for having me on your show. I appreciate it. I also am a child abuse survivor. Mine was a little different than Bill's. I was abused by my mother since I was two, as far as I can remember, and I was sexually molested by two of my uncles. Well, one wasn't an uncle, but we were supposed to call them uncles. From the time I was five and six.
Oh, my. So it seems then that there's a pattern that I'm sort of beginning to sense here, that a person who is abused by one person can become vulnerable to being abused by a number of people.
Yes. And when you're a child.
Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was also going to say that I'm trying to process what you've told me, you know, because you're saying that the abuse started when you were 2 years old and basically comprised the entirety of your childhood.
Yes, that's correct.
This is not unusual. I'm sorry, Jessica, but another figure that you might find interesting, and then we'll get right back to Jessica, is that 20% of the people who are abused are 8 years old or younger, and most of them don't tell anyone. In fact, a lot of them don't even remember the experience, but 20% of those that are abused, it starts at eight or under, so she's not unusual in that sense at all.
Wow. Well, you know, Jessica, then that does bring me to that question. How did you survive?
Well, let's see. It wasn't easy surviving such abuse because first of all, I had no one to turn to. I couldn't turn to my mother because she was very abusive, and when I did tell her, she just hit me more and just told me that this is something I shouldn't repeat to anybody. As far as the two men that were involved in this issue, they knew about the abuse that my mom gave me as a child, so they become like sort of my best friends, you know, trying to protect me, and it was their way of luring me as a child, and me not knowing what sex was at that age, you felt safe, you know. It's like taking a little child and putting them on your lap, and then you're just pounding on the floor and like a little horsey ride. You don't see any harm in doing that, you know, and so you kind of gain sort of a trust with these people because you had no one else to turn to, okay? So they take that opportunity to hurt you when at that point you don't know that you're being hurt. Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, because, you know, your world and what's normal in your world is in many ways defined by the adults in your world, right?
Right. So, you kind of grow up secluded, you know, I mean, I was abused just by anything, really. It wasn't something that you do something bad and then, you know, you're getting beat up. And I'm talking about beat up, meaning lots of welts and cuts on your body and wires and belts and stuff like that. You know, it's like I became the perfect child, okay? So I figured if I did everything right and if I pay attention and I have respect, I would get hit less. Okay, well, sometimes it wasn't the case, because regardless, is depending on your mother's mood, you got it anyways, you know. But I just buried myself in my schoolwork, became an A student. I became really secluded. I alienated myself away from people, became shy, and that's how I grew up. And my only thing was that I suffered in silence. And, you know, it's really hard to remember how many times I went to bed crying, just knowing what I'm facing the next day. So I ran away from home, you know, from the tender age of 7. I've been running away from home, attempted suicide up until I was 17 years old, which almost took my life the last time.
You said that you ran away from home when you were 7. What happened
seven.
With that?
Well, let's see. It was my mom had beat me so bad that I was so terrified. I found a way to get out of my house, and I started just running. And I didn't live too far from the Passaic County Falls, so that's where I ran to. And one of my neighbor's son, who was older than me, helped me get there. And he had bagged a bag full of food and a pillow and a blanket for me. And he helped me get to that fall. And that was the first time I attempted suicide, was when I saw apparently my mother found out that this boy had helped me do this. They found me at the top of the mountain on the Passaic County Fall, and when I saw them coming, I jumped. And as I jumped, my hair went flying up, and the landlord of the apartment we were living in got a hold of my hair and pulled me up.
Okay.
That's how they saved me, or else I wouldn't be here today.
Oh, boy. But, I mean, you say that they saved you, and yet they were returning you to the
exactly.
environment.
Exactly. Yeah,
and
because
that actually you're telling... Mm-hmm.
That was the first time that my father at the time was there with my mom to come with the landlord and find me. And when this guy pulled me up and I got in the car, you would think that a normal mother would hold you and say, why did you do this? The first thing she did was slap me right in front of everybody and put me in the car. And my dad was silent. And all I said to him was, Daddy, why are you letting me stay here? You know, all I kept saying on the way home was, I want to die. I don't want to be here. Because I knew what was going to happen to me once he left. And I wasn't wrong.
So people were aware of what was going on. You know, the question started to come up for me when you said that this neighbor, the boy, you know, brought you food and a pillow. You know, that he knew to do that means that you communicated something to him, and that perhaps his parents were aware of what was going on. What happened with people who became aware, or at least suspected, what was going on?
Well, my the friend that I was talking to you about, his family didn't know what was going on. The only thing was that they found out that night was that I had ran away from home and that their son helped me. And my mom was really good at lying. You know, it was always blamed on me that I was a bad child, that I didn't listen, and I was going to get punished, and that's why I ran away from home. But what people failed to see was my scarring, the bruises, the welts. You know, why was this child wearing long sleeve shirts and knee-high socks in the middle of summer? You know, I mean, it was there. The sadness was there. The crying was there. And nobody saw that. You know, there wasn't no questions. This was normal to them. Okay, this reminded me of the movie Carrie, how she dressed, her mom dressed her up with long dresses, and she went to school looking so sad and alone and weird. That's how I felt.
Well, so you obviously endured a horrific childhood. At some point, though, I mean, you're talking about it now. You made it through to your adulthood. What happened for you to allow you to start dealing with what you experienced as a child?
It wasn't until I was 17, the last time I attempted suicide, that I was actually put in a mental institution for 3 months. And they told me that I was going to either, if I continue this path of destruction, they were going to put me away, period. And then I was sent to see psychologists, and I couldn't relate to them exactly what had happened. They just couldn't understand where I was coming from and why I was doing the way I was. I was terrified, you know, scared. I didn't want to talk to anybody about it, so I just shut down. And all I kept saying was, I just don't want to be here. I don't belong here. I'm not happy, you know. And then once I got out of this hospital, they sent me to psychologists, which I saw. They tried to get this out of me, and I wouldn't talk. Then I went to a group therapy, which I felt, they felt that it would be more helpful to me than on one-on-one, because you have to remember, the psychologists I went to were men, okay? I did not trust men, okay? I had this thing about men. And when I went to a group therapy, I didn't want to go in there because I was scared. You know, it's something, it's like, this only happened to you. Who's going to understand what you've been through? You know, are they going to think I'm a freak? You know, is this my fault? But it wasn't until I walked into that room and I saw a lot of people there that also went through the same things I went through. And that helped me talk a little bit about it. Then after that, after I got out of that, I ended up getting married at 1 day shy of my 18th birthday to the wrong guy, who was also turned out to be abusive. And it was just an escalation out of there because I wasn't talking. I didn't know what was going on. I remember some things I forgot. I wanted to just not think about it. But then I became a loner. I didn't get close to people. And then I realized that one day I was going to have children. And I didn't want to pass this abuse to my children because later I found out that my mom was also an abused child. So what I did is I went through therapy for 2 years. I did that so I wouldn't be an abusive parent if I ever had children, which helped me a lot. It also helped deal with my anger, because I had a lot of anger inside of me. I just didn't show it. I just buried it. And it helped a lot. And then I met Bill, and Bill told me about his organization. And the first, I would say the last 3 weeks, I still broke down a little bit just talking about it because the memories were very painful to me to this day. And just talking to Dr. J and MJ and Bill helped me to understand that I was not alone, that it was not my fault. And I was able to deal with it a lot better, knowing that I had other people there who were listening and supportive, and there was help for me, which helps me now become a better person who I am right now in order to extend my services and help to somebody else who needs it.
And you know, that's something that I see as being so important for people who are survivors, that something happens in your life that makes you sit up and stop and say, you know what, I need to get help. And allows you to reach out and get that help. But not only that, this feeling of needing to do what you can to help other people who are also survivors, and then also help in terms of prevention.
Exactly.
You know, something that I'm learning is very important, and it sounds like that has been important for you in your life.
Exactly. And you learn as a child. As a child, you learn everything that's happened to you. It helps you grow as an adult person. It helps you better your own life in recognizing the signs of your own children that you have. It's getting to know your kids, okay? If the child's a happy kid, then you know that the child's happy and healthy. But then all of a sudden, your child makes a U-turn into a sad child, a child that doesn't want to play or doesn't want to relate to adults. I mean, these are little things that you learn to look for in other children, because when I was small, nobody saw that. And if they did, they probably just, you know, didn't think anything of it. But now, looking to where I am right now, I can actually look at a child and study the child and see if this is a happy child, if the child's going through abuse, you know, why are they sad? Why are they secluded? Why are they not doing good in school? Why are they retaliating? You know, you learn to pick up those signs.
Well, Jessica, you're bringing me actually very nicely to a sort of segue to talking with Dr. J. But I first want to, again, thank you so much for coming forward, for having the courage to speak publicly about what happened in your life and about how it is that you've managed to handle it and come to a place where you can be useful to other people who have survived what you survived as well.
Right.
Thank you so much.
It's been a lesson learned the hard way.
Unfortunately, that's so true for so many people. But what you're doing perhaps can cut down on that number significantly.
Thing is that, you know, it does affect you as an adult carrying a secret, this nightmare for years. You know, you wonder why you're afraid of commitment. You're afraid of having a good relationship with someone. You wonder why they question you, why you hide, like you hide cords, and you don't want to tell them, you know, because you're afraid. You're afraid because of how they're going to look at you, you know. But it does affect you, and it does help to talk about it, because once you release that pain, that anger that you've been carrying for so many years, that is one step closer to healing.
Of course, yes. Now, you just said something, and I want to make sure that I heard this correctly. You said that people would wonder why you were hiding cords.
Yes. I have a phobia to this day. My mom didn't believe in hitting you with her hands. She had belts, and it wasn't just the strap, it was the buckle. So she had this thing that if she hits you, it has to bleed. Okay? I was the type of kid that was. My mom had this thing about taking, I have no idea why they did this, but whenever she beat me, it was my clothes had come off, I was put in a cold shower, and whether it was a cord of an extension cord, a hanger of a wire, or a buckle, she would hit you like that in cold water while you're naked. And one time I heard her say something that she says that, when you hit somebody with a cord in cold water, it hurts that much worse. Okay, so to me,
for it to be worse.
Yes, it's supposed to sting more. But I feel like whether it's cold water or no water, any child that gets hit in the way I've been hit, it has to hurt. It's not just the water. But me, I have no wire hangers in my house today. I can't stand seeing them. Wires, even if it's extension cords or wires from TVs, it has to be hidden and away from my vision, because it just reminds me of my trauma.
Right. So I mean, this.
But I'm getting better.
Right.
I'm getting better.
One of the things is that you do have to be gentle with yourself and sort of accept that you know, this is residue from, and heavy residue from what happened, and recognizing that you know, your concerns about cords and wire hangers and that sort of thing are stemming from that experience. But I think that for everybody who's listening, it's important for them to understand that when you witness a child going through these things, understand that they don't just get over it, that the impact is long-lasting and can have significant impact significantly into adulthood.
Yes.
Jessica, if you don't mind, thank you so much. I'm going to bring in Dr. J. And,
no, not at all.
Thank you. Dr. J, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit more about what your practice is about and what you've observed working with people who are survivors of childhood molestation.
Well, first of all, thank you for having us. And I will try. I've been actually been sitting here making some notes when both Bill and Jessica were talking on things I could bring up. One of the things I want to bring up first was she was talking about the cords and ropes and stuff like that. And one of the things that abuse survivors suffer from is post-traumatic stress disorder. And one of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder is triggers, you know, either things that they see, smell, hear, okay, that'll trigger the memories of their abuse. And that's why the cords have such a huge impact on Jessica. You know, yeah. they're triggers. So,
you know, that's something I think that most people can understand. If you've had a particular object that has been used as a weapon against you, you're going to have issues with that object into adulthood. What other things can you tell us about the impact of childhood molestation, both on children and into adulthood?
The impact can be devastating. It affects every area of your life. Especially your ability to connect with other people, because you really don't trust anybody. So a lot of people are very isolated. They have difficulty with having relationships. They tend to sabotage themselves because they feel so much shame about who they are and guilt about what they've done. So, it goes all kinds of mental health issues, all kinds of substance abuse issues, all kinds of self-destructive behavior, are associated with abuse.
And then in your practice, I understand that you've also worked with people who have engaged in child molestation. Is that right?
I've worked with sex offenders. I've worked with people that are on their way to becoming sex offenders, that have sexual addiction, impulsive or compulsive sexual behavior.
You know, there's a question as I was preparing for the show. A question came to me, and I wanted to ask you. And I'm sure that many listeners are both, well, frankly, disgusted and bewildered by the behavior of sex offenders. Is there a way to recognize who's most likely to violate your child?
Let me tell you that I wrote this down right at the beginning, and I think this is a really, really important part of the puzzle. Okay, other than be awareness of the parents, you need to have a really good relationship with your kids.
Yes.
Yeah, you really need to
can't
be able. They need to trust you.
Right.
Okay? They need to be able to talk to you and feel comfortable talking to you about anything. They also need to have a very healthy view of sexuality.
Okay.
That will definitely take care of a lot of the shame that they might feel if someone approaches them to do something sexually that they don't want to do. You know, they will understand what sexuality is about and what's right and what's wrong.
So that they're basically, educated. When a person approaches them, they are not dealing with someone who is so naive that they are open to being victimized.
Absolutely. You know, if a kid is loved and accepted and feels good about themselves, they're less likely to be in a position to be abused, to be taken advantage of.
Right. Well, here's something that I'm wondering about and sort of would be bringing Bill back into this. Bill, my understanding is that in your family, even though you were adopted, you have a very large, extensive family, and that you did feel loved by your parents. But still, when you were approached by this camp counselor, you weren't able to know what was going on, and then also you didn't feel able to tell your parents. So between you, Dr. J, and also Bill, I know that there are parents who are listening who say, I love my children. I'm still not sure that I'm doing the right thing.
And what's the question?
Well, yeah, I guess basically the question is, maybe I should just dive into it, which is the main topic of today. I can imagine as a parent saying, you know, I love my kids. They know I love them. I want them to feel that they can talk to me about anything, but I don't know how to even begin to talk to them about this. I'm not comfortable talking about sex in general, and now I'm supposed to talk with my children.
Well, you know, if you really want to be a good parent, get comfortable with it.
Okay.
Get comfortable with it because it's part of being a human being.
Okay.
Sexuality is a part of all of us. And
may
excuse me?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dr. J.
No, I was just going to say, you know, and if we're uncomfortable and feel shame about sex and sexuality, you better believe our kids are going to pick up on that and have a lot of confusion about sex and sexuality.
And from
exactly.
what I'm hearing from you, that increases their vulnerability. Jessica, please go ahead.
Well, I raised two sons, okay, and my children were educated from the very time they can actually talk and understand at their level what mommy was trying to tell them. Reason being is when children, I wanted my children to know they can trust me with anything they have, okay? I talked to them about their body parts from, I believe, when they started daycare at 3. You know, and I was telling them what they have, what a woman has, and there are books in the library that will show you how to talk to your child about sex, their body parts and stuff in their level, so they can understand, you know, what you're trying to tell them. Because me having to work, I had to put my children in daycare, and because I had a trust issue with people, I wanted my children to know that no one can touch them and telling them what was right and wrong, and they can come to me and tell me if anybody was doing something they weren't supposed to. And from the time they were little that I was able to talk to them, even when they went out to play with their friends, you know, I always call on them just to make sure they were okay. I always ask them to call me. I always ask them where they're going. It was a relationship that we built from the time they were little, in order for them to talk to me about anything. And to this day, my children are adult young men, and they can still talk to mom about anything without being ashamed.
I guess that is so very important. You know, when Bill was talking about his story, Jessica, one of the things that came to my mind was that he said that he didn't know what sex was, and he didn't know really what was going on with the person who abused him. I suppose that children who are being abused get the sense that this isn't something they're supposed to talk about, either because the abuser tells them not to talk about it, or because everything's happening in secret, and so they're able to figure that out. But the very fact that he said that he didn't know what was going on tells me that there was no talk about sex at home. And so go ahead.
Way back then. Back then, when we were kids, okay, sex is not something that parents talked about to their children. Okay, that was like a no-no thing. All right, nowadays it's more open, but
no,
still,
it isn't, Jessica. I wish I could say different, but no, it isn't. Parents today have as big a problem talking to their kids about sex as they ever have.
And you are absolutely right about that. You're absolutely right about that. And some of the parents that I've dealt with who have a problem talking to their children about sex, they tell me that they were old, grown up, old school, that was nothing, you know, you don't talk about because sex is something you don't tell your children. Some parents, I have friends who have kids who won't talk to their kids about sex because they don't think it's right. They even belittle me for even talking to my children about sex at a young age.
Well, the idea is that if you don't talk about it, they won't find out about it, which is, you know, total. Any of us that have grown up, okay, realize that you find out about it because it's a biological thing, that it's a biological urge that takes place in all of us. You know, so not talking about it doesn't make kids not find out about it. At least if parents are responsible and talk to their kids, they'll get the correct information. or they're more likely to.
And I want to mention that it wasn't...
Go ahead, Bill.
I wanted to make two quick points. One is that a lot of children are molested in their own home, and 90% of kids, in any case, even if it's not happening in their own home, they're molested by someone they think they can love, trust, you know, love and trust, or a friend. So that's one big problem. The second thing is that in my case, as Jessica said, way back when, I guess she means covered wagon times or whatever, when I was growing up.
In the olden days.
In the olden days, right, Jessica? Is that what she said? She used that phrase, in the olden days.
In the olden days, yes.
Hey, listen, I remember when color television came into existence, so I admit I got some years on me. But back then, it wasn't just a question of they didn't talk about sex. They didn't talk about life at all. And this is just how I was raised. I saw very little affection either between the two of them. I saw the occasional hug and a peck, you know. I got an occasional hug and a peck. I also as often got a pat on the head, you know. But there wasn't a lot of warmth, in other words, in my immediate family. So that was part of the problem. And when I, at age 11, went off for that month, you know, by the time I was finished with that first month's experience, I had a month of experience every day of this going on that I knew I couldn't talk about. And when they picked me up, I didn't talk about it. Instead, I went off and I asked kids, and I kept my ears open on the playground, what was this thing sex about? And that's where I learned the beginning of whatever I came to understand was, you know, the sex. I also knew the shame of having a relationship at all with a man. I mean, that seemed odd to me, but I didn't know how bad it was till I found out on the playground. So there's a lot of shame in that for me. And the point of all this is, Jessica and I know, and I think Dr. J too, we all raised children. We all have successful children. Jessica has two beautiful boys in their 20s, and they couldn't be more proud of what their mom is doing today, by the way. They love her very much. And I'm privileged to have raised a daughter who is now 21. She's a junior in college. And just like Jessica, from the moment she was born, before she could talk, I've been talking to her openly at age-specific levels and telling her, in addition to the fact that I'll always love her no matter what, and she can always come to me with anything no matter what, and I'll answer all her questions no matter what, and there's nothing she can do, you know, that'll drive me away from her. She'll make mistakes, but it's okay if she learns from them, and all these things. Every time she brought a question to me, I answered it age-specifically, and then she would be satisfied until I saw that she was satisfied with the answer, and she'd go away. And the next time she had a question, it could be 2 weeks later, she'd come back and ask that. I'd answer that as honestly as I could, but age-specific, she'd go away. The result is, you know, I think I raised a daughter who knew that she could come to daddy with anything, and that she wasn't going to be belittled, she wasn't going to be punished, she wasn't going to be ridiculed. She was going to be listened to, and I would answer her the best I could for the age, you know, level she was at. Now, that's what Jessica and I each did, because another one of the hallmarks of this is unfortunately, it's true, a lot of molested people, if they don't get recovery, will pass that on to their own children. In other words, it's like a family problem in a lot of cases, and it's what they grew up with. It's what they understand. It's the family life they know. They know how to live their life, you know, their family. I didn't get that. I got at least a family who, you know, was fulfilling in other ways. They didn't give me a lot of sex advice, or they didn't give me any knowledge of what life is all about either, but I never sensed that they didn't love me. That was really important in my story. And so that's, you know, but it is a fact that we got to break this cycle as early as possible, because a lot of today's molesters are yesterday's molestees, you know, and their parents were molested too. And we got to break the cycle as early as possible. One of the things Dr. J, of course, is doing is to intercede as soon as possible, you know, and get people into recovery from these things as quickly as possible. So this is our mission.
Right. Bill, you're bringing up a number of really important points. What I'm hoping, and thank you so much, but what I'm hoping for is at some point we can sort of bullet point for people who are listening how they can begin to understand what resources that they can turn to, so that when they're concerned about being age appropriate, for example, or giving the best information for the child in the moment. They know what resources they can turn to help them do that. So I'd like to bracket that for a moment and come back to it. But, Bill, you said something that I'd sort of like to address and talk through. I've heard you talk about it before, but I'd like you to talk about it here now. You mentioned that if the people who abused you happened to be men. And, of course, I think for many people listening, the issue of homosexuality then comes up. And, you know, what does it mean for a boy to be having that kind of experience with all of the issues that are surrounding it? Could you talk a little bit about what you have learned?
Sure. Not only were they men, but, you know, the first guy, as I said, I went to the same summer camp 3 summers in a row. So he was my single molester, but 3 summers in a row for a month at a time, solid, he molested me. And it culminated with him kidnapping me, and that's another story. And for 2 weeks, he had me at his mercy, and he tried to get me to interact with other people. And during that period of time was the first time he ever asked me to do anything aggressive or I was always the object. And I kept refusing, and it infuriated him that I wouldn't do anything with either him or any of the people he introduced me to. So when I went away to high school, which was immediately following that experience, I had chosen to go to high school where the teachers were priests and brothers. And one of the priests asked me if I'd ever had any homosexual experiences, and I denied it. And he asked again, and I denied it. And the third time, or the fourth time he asked, I decided, I guess I better go talk to this guy. And I did. And he heard my story. I revealed all the things that I've talked to you about in detail. And at the end of it, he gave me absolution. It was kind of a confession. But unfortunately, he himself was interested in me. And he told another priest, who told a brother, who told an upperclassman, who told someone in college, and so forth. So especially the first 2 years at this place I went to high school, I was running away from all males who were coming on to me constantly. And you know, in my last 2 years, I was big enough to kind of fend off myself. But it was a terrifying, horrifying experience. And I brought into my adulthood very little experience with women, all this experience at the hands of men, and not feeling attracted to men in the least. And I one of the things I did was I obsessed with women. And so I spent, you know, part of my 20s, of all of my 20s, I'd have to be honest to say, you know, using my story as a weapon to get sex off of women because I wanted women to fix me. And I found out I was heterosexual, not homosexual. But the shame of the fact that my early experience never let me deal with it in a healthy way until, as I say, in sobriety, I realized I had better start talking about it. And I think the thing you're talking about was that I ended up getting sober in Hollywood because most of my career was in California in film and television and show business. And I found myself in rooms where about every third person was a gay man. And I was terrified to tell my story. But by telling my story a little bit at a time, I found out that they came over to me and they would give me a hug, a non-sexual hug, and say, you know, we don't want you for your body. We want you for your sobriety. Keep coming back and keep talking about this. And right away, it started to melt, you know, this prejudice that I had, naturally so, against, I thought, homosexuals and priests. And it started to put it in the right place, which was, you know, I learned eventually that I didn't have a problem with homosexuals. I had a problem with pedophiles who happened to be men. And likewise, I didn't have a problem with all of Catholicism and all priests, but I certainly did with priests and brothers who had taken vows and turned out to be pedophiles. That I had a problem with. And so, you know, but you have to get to a place where you're willing to tell your story in a safe environment and have those kinds of experiences to get to a realization like that. And today I'm very comfortable with all the ministers and priests that I come in contact with. And although I'm not a regular practicing Catholic, I have nothing particular. I'm not hell-bent against Catholicism like I unfortunately hear a lot of molested people doing. I do belong to Bishop Accountability, and I want to hold them accountable. But I don't blame all priests or all religious any more than all teachers or all camp counselors.
Right. And then again, you were able to delve into the issue of your own sexuality and then also separate the fact of certain people being pedophiles from the fact that they happen to be all men, and so understood that it's not a homosexual issue, it's a pedophile issue.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing that, for bringing that sort of clarity to it. Now, I'd like to ask the three of you if you could help a bit with listeners who are wondering, how do I begin, at what age do I begin to talk with my children? What is age appropriate? And, you know, how do I find resources that can help me to talk about something that I feel uncomfortable talking about right now?
Right. Well, I posted, while you were talking, I went ahead and did a Google search.
Yeah.
And I found, I did a Google search for Planned Parenthood, and Planned Parenthood has a section in there for parents on how to talk to their kids about sex, and it breaks it down by age.
Wonderful. Okay, so Planned Parenthood is one resource that people can go to find, you know, maybe books, links to other websites, I suppose they might have in there, where you can actually get help understanding what is age appropriate and what you need to say
right
to your children.
I mean, if you go into the website, it breaks it down by age. It talks about what's age appropriate for different ages, starting I guess at age 3.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
I agree.
So,
I used resources in the library also for a child, how to talk to your child about sex. And to me, it's like, is it really age appropriate sometimes? Because I started at 3, but the youngest child I have ever read that was sexually molested was 9 months old. 9 months. Is
yeah,
that fitting or what?
I've had children that were sexually molested, you know, a lot younger, you know, a lot younger than 3 that I've worked with, you know, that age 2 or, you know, but unless you start educating people, unless you start working on mental health issues, we tend to think that one of the less important things that we need to worry about in this country is mental health issues. Well, mental health issues affect everything, every part of our society. And if we don't work on those things, okay, they're going to harm us. And they do harm us on a daily basis. Yeah, so we need to look after the mental health of our citizens. That's a really big part of having a healthy society. And if we have a healthy society, the number of incidents of child abuse will be minimal.
Right. Well, you're
Well, I want to mention that, you know, I don't want us to get off this topic before letting people know that, you know, while our primary purpose is to help adults get into recovery who have never done so, our secondary is to help with all the other issues that we're talking about tonight, including helping parents find the right ways to raise their kids. And they need to go to our site to look no further than that's the beginning point. And we'll add the thing that Jay just found himself to it. But if they go to the NASCA site, NAASCA.org, under the recovery button, is stuff for adults who need to get into recovery. But under the next button over, resources, the first thing they'll find is all kinds of resources that'll help parents deal with their children, also about how to report things that they think are suspicious. There are 5 websites there that are age-specific that they can share with their kids, because a lot of kids, you know, are internet savvy, so they want to look at the internet. And it starts from a young age, and it works into childhood, into adolescence. So you pick the one that's most appropriate. Yeah.
Right, great.
And we'll Go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. We're going to come to a couple of things that you've mentioned. One has to do with recognizing the signs of abuse in someone, and then also talking about the ways in which pedophiles reach out to children. But I'm seeing that I have a caller here on the line in the 646 area code, and I want to bring somebody in here to ask questions. And for those of you who are listening, the phone lines are open, and if you're having trouble getting in, do keep trying. But we want you to have an opportunity to speak directly with Bill and Jessica and Dr. J so that you can ask your questions. I'm not the only person who has questions, I'm sure. So if you have questions, feel free to go ahead and call in. But the person in the 646 area code, I'm coming to you. Your mic is on. Hi, hello there.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear
hello.
You.
Hello. Okay, good. My question, I have a few questions, so stop me whenever necessary.
Sure.
The first question is for, excuse me, the first question is for Jessica. Initially you had said, it's funny because I wanted to ask you a question, but then you clarified, but it still brings up another kind of question in my head. You'd said that your mother abused you, you were two. I know that most, I'm sorry?
No, you're right. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Originally, I thought that you were talking about sexual abuse by your mother, and I just want to clarify that it was more physical abuse and not sexual abuse that your mother was
no.
Doing.
Yes, my mother was abusive physically.
Right.
She was not sexually, but physically.
Right. And then that brought up another question for Bill, which was you dealt with same-sex abuse. So it was men who were abusing you. But have you come in contact with women or men who as children, their mothers or females in their lives, had been sexually abusing them?
Oh, sure. And it's more usual that the Dr. J can probably speak statistically to this, but it is more usual that it's men who are abusers. But it's not unheard of by any means that women can't be abusers as well. And in fact, women can be abusers of boys. That happens too. So you know, but in my case, you know, it was all men, a number of them. And that was part of the shame of it, because not understanding, again, what homosexuality was, all I knew was, you know, the only time I'd ever had sex was at the hands of men, and I'd always been their object. I'd never felt attracted to them, but I was attracted, and this is part of the guilt, to the sensations, if you will, you know, those, and the attention, and so forth. And that was a big part of the shame, you know, that I went back. That I didn't have the strength to say no and so forth. So I dragged that right into my adulthood and drank behind it, and I used the story to get sex off of people like yourself, females. And in sobriety, when I started to uncover what was going on and then come to terms with it, one of the things I had to do was make a promise to myself and to the world that I would talk about this, but only in an appropriate environment, and never use it as a weapon to get sex again. That was a big deal for me.
Okay, another question I have for you then is, you have said that your adopted family, which is your family, were loving, but I'm wondering, because it's come up a couple times, did you feel in any way neglected? Because on the one hand, you feel like maybe you were continuing the abuse because of a need of attention. Were there other siblings in your family, and maybe part of why you didn't say anything is because you weren't asked? Maybe you were neglected in some way?
I'd say more I felt I was misunderstood than neglected, certainly not physically neglected. I grew up in a solidly middle-class environment. My parents both were college-educated. My mother went back to college when my sister and I were in our grade school years, and she completed a degree that she'd had to give up on account of World War II, and she went on to do, you know, 20 years as a librarian in the public library system. She put herself through school to do that. So the model that I was given was really a good model, but I always felt inside of me that there was a genetic difference, and I assumed that was why, for example, I had a lot of creative juices flowing in me that nobody else in my family, and I had 60 cousins. As far as I knew, none of them had any of this going on, and I just attributed it to the fact that genetically I came from somebody else. So I did pursue creative, you know, the arts and so forth, and I became involved in all kinds of things that my parents didn't understand. They thought it was okay to be interested in music if it was for a hobby, but not for a career, you know, or photography for the same thing, or filmmaking, or any, you know, acting, anything like that. That was okay for a hobby, but not for a career. Of course, I went on to do a 30-year career. I guess I'm still semi-involved in it because I'm kind of semi-retired in show business. So it wasn't that I felt neglected. It was I felt misunderstood. And I had a reason. I told myself a reason, you know.
Finally, it does make sense.
Did you have
my last question? Yeah, is for Dr. J, which is given what we just heard about the feeling misunderstood, and no disrespect, Bill, but it sounds like the model that you received in my mind seems functional. But I'm wondering if it was a very loving and attentive model. And Dr. J, if you could speak to that in some way. And then also, one of the things that Jessica had said earlier was that she felt like, at one point she had said, today people are a little bit more open about sex, and I think there was a contradiction or a challenge to that notion. And I wanted to say that I think that people, there is more openness about sex than, say, 30 years ago or 40 years ago. But in my mind, it seems like there are more mixed messages about sex. Like there's a lot more sex on television than there was in the 70s or the 60s.
Or the
50s, and there's no question about that. But I'm just wondering if the parents who you say are not talking to their kids that feel uncomfortable, I mean, how is that against the backdrop of highly sexualized and conflicting messages about sex in various media?
That's a powder
internet,
keg, actually. It's a powder keg because the kids don't know what to do, and then you throw in the internet and instant communications and all this kind of stuff, and you're having all kinds of problems. You know that a generation ago we didn't have because we didn't have the internet. It's kids are growing up so much faster, and they need that information so much quicker. Self-esteem is going down the tubes, especially for females. One of the things I did want to mention is that Bill mentioned about more men are molesters, and there's quite a few females that molest other females and young males, but there's a double standard. The double standard is it's kind of expected for boys. You know, that's kind of like an attaboy for a boy that has sex with someone that's older than them. Okay, you know, it's like the older woman teaching the young boy about sex. There was a movie years ago, The Summer of 42.
Right,
it was a rite of passage. Right. Okay. And it's viewed just the opposite when it comes to a girl engaging in sexual activity with someone older than herself. Okay. Totally different.
So,
you know, but it happens, and it has an effect. And I've worked with people where yes, they had a sexual encounter with someone that was older, with a male having a sexual encounter with someone that was older than them. Okay. When they were a kid, and it did had a negative effect on them. You know, so it does happen.
Well, that's one of the things that I want to bring forward about why I was glad to be able to have the three of you doing this show with me, because Jessica is there, but the stereotype is that it's girls who are being molested, and that what happens with boys may be viewed a little bit differently. And so I'm glad that Bill is here as well to talk about that perspective, because we do hear from men so much less.
And there's fewer resources for men as well.
Well, that's one of the issues that drove me to start. That's one of the issues that drove me to start what we're doing. We do highlight those things that we can find, but the fact is that, if you're a child and it's found out that you're being abused, there are lots of resources there are more resources now that kick in to help a child, even extract them, for example, from the home where they're being abused if necessary, and there's all kinds of services. But once you get into adulthood, there's nothing there. And since most of us carry these things as secrets into adulthood, the vast majority of people who are abused get into their adulthood without being in recovery, and they carry that with them for decades. So I know this because I've looked for support groups and other therapies and so forth, and they do exist, but they're very tough to find, and there's very little that's really supported, and especially for men. There are, at least in terms of women, there are things like abuse hotlines and women's groups and rape counseling and those kinds of things. But for men, there's none of that. So this is part of what we do. Of course, we work with both sexes. We work with every kind of abuse, sexual abuse, violent abuse, emotional abuse, neglect, you know, all of it. I just happen to have the experience of being a young man at one time who could find no, you know, when I went and told the person I was supposed to be able to trust, it turned out he was not trustworthy. And from that point on, I shut down. And I decided I would deal with it myself, and that was the wrong thing to do. So now we want to offer.
I mean, understandable, because you took the brave step of reaching out to someone, and it unfortunately did turn out to be the wrong person. So, of course, I think it would make sense, especially coming from the perspective of a child, that you learned your lesson.
Can I address one other thing about the question that the caller asked about?
We want to be is the right place for people to come, and we'll do whatever we can to work with them. That's why we started this. Sorry, Jay, go ahead.
I was
going to talk about parenting and good parenting and bad parenting, and it was you know, one of her questions was about that. I think we do the best we can. I mean, if you really look at the parenting that Bill's parents did, yeah, there wasn't talk about sex. You know, he didn't feel comfortable talking to them about everything. Our view of our childhoods, you know, is the only view that we have of what a family is supposed to be like. You know, and, you know, on a scale of, let's say, 1 to 10, as far as Leave It to Beaver type families, Bill probably had an 8.
Sure.
You know, yeah. there was definitely stuff lacking, and I think a lot of that had to do with cultural and religious beliefs, you know, that people have about what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And what good parenting is, what good parenting is, and what good parenting isn't. I mean, some cultures the parents are more affectionate with their kids than they are in other cultures. So, you know, I mean, there's a variety of factors that go into it.
So what we know for sure then is that it's not enough just to have a typically loving family where both parents are in the home. And, you know, there's respect and the children are not being beaten and the parents themselves are not abusing the children, but that there has to be an openness that the parents build into the relationship with their children so that the children know that they can come and talk with them about anything. I think we've heard from both Jessica and Bill about how they really inculcated that with their children and lived up to it so that when the child came and asked a question, you know, there was never a sort of, oh, you're not supposed to talk about that, or,
right.
You know, but you answered their questions in an age-appropriate way, but frankly and openly and without hesitation.
And then the question, you know, remains is, so how do we learn to be parents? Okay? And what basically the way we learn to be parents is by watching ours. Okay? And that's not necessarily the best way to learn how to be a parent because we're picking up all their bad habits too. You know,
okay.
I think that you know, if this is something that probably be, you know, politically incorrect today, but I think that in order to have a child, you need to be you should be required to take parenting classes and learn how to be a parent. I mean, if you have to take driving lessons and sit for a test to drive a car, you know, I think being a parent is a lot more important.
Oh, well, sure. And you're not the first person I've heard saying this, and I thought the same thing myself. Isn't it ironic that you have to go through all kinds of tests to get a driver's license or to do any number of other things. But when it comes to shaping another person's life, you know, how more important of a task could there be than that? And yet there are so few... well, let me put it this way. It's not that there aren't resources out there. It's just not part of our culture to instruct people on being parents before they've become parents, but we all do sort of blindly wander around trying to pick things up.
I would say there ought to be a law.
Yeah,
you know, before you can conceive a child, you have to take parenting classes and learn how to be a parent.
You could say the same thing about any number of other things, and it's a shame we have to say it that way. But the thing that we were talking about before that this is about is the taboo of talking about real sexuality. It's not taboo,
sure,
as the caller said, to talk about sex in terms of the model that sells the sports car on TV and the reality show that we're presented, and it's supposed to be, you know, how our kids emulate, you know, what their lives and so forth. That's all fine. But the real stuff about sexuality, it's a taboo topic in America. That's another thing that we want. We're consciously aware of wanting to break that mold and offer, you know, a better resource and information if we can through what we do, because we have to educate each other. And furthermore, unfortunately, a lot of these kids that are being molested and just kids that are being raised the way they're being raised, a lot of single family situations and so forth, there's an opportunity for those of us who are community members who are healthy and have some time on our hands to give of ourselves in a way as a community thing, and kind of like the community policing thing that we talk about, where there is a way to participate in this that helps even children that aren't our own, you know, perhaps, by being a big brother, I don't know, things like that, you know, because there are a lot of kids out there who don't have a good model in their immediate family. And we always see that in the gang situation where the gang member, you know, was brought up by a gang member, his father, whose brother was also a gang member, and oh, by the way, their father was a gang member, the grandpa. Well, no wonder the kid wants to go into a gang. It's the family business. So unless someone gets in there and intercedes to that kid and says there's a different way of life, it's really all he knows. And,
right.
You know, so we need to break that.
Well, you know, it's become sort of a cliche now, this idea of it takes a village to raise a child, but really it does. And I would like to get into talking about interventions where people are recognizing that there are issues with children who perhaps are not living in their own homes, who are not biologically their own, but feel a sense of responsibility as part of the community. So if we could start first, we touched on it a little bit, but could we talk again about how to recognize the signs of a child who is perhaps being abused?
Sure. One of the pages on our site is called Resources, one of the tabs, and the first tab there lists any number of things, including this. I will add the site that Jay just offered to us and another site that he offered to us a few days ago, and these are lists of things that you can look for in children that might be alarms, you know, to what to look for, and they break it down in terms of different kinds of abuse, too. There's sexual abuse, there's neglect, there's violence abuse, and so forth. These things are broken down. And the information is there, about also coming from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and you can click on a few more things and get a lot of information that tells you, you know, how to protect your child. But as Jessica says, there's also books available now that are being written on this. There's, as I mentioned earlier, there's online materials. We list five specific ones that I myself have looked at that are at different ages, age appropriate, that the parent can use or can use with the kid, you know, and they'll answer a lot of these questions and so forth too. But get the dialogue started. That's the big hurdle. Once it's started and they know they can come back, and they can engage again, and they're not going to be ridiculed with no question is too, you know, silly to answer, no question is wrong, you know, then they will come back. So I think this relationship building is really important, and it is something a community can do if the child is, say, an at-risk type child who's growing up in an environment that otherwise they're not going to get the good information at home.
So then you're talking about being open and having perhaps kids know, if you're a teacher, perhaps you're more likely to be in a position to work with kids. If you've got kids living in your apartment complex, you know, perhaps you might see something. What can a person expect to happen if they, let's say, reach out to authorities, or, you know, they feel that they need to get somebody else involved who can actually take action where they see that the parents are not intervening?
Okay, every state has an abuse hotline. You would call the abuse hotline. You can. It's a tip line that you can actually report anonymously. You don't need to give your name, okay? And you know, basically that's basically what you would do, and then it would be investigated. You know, whether they do a good enough job is questionable, because there's a lot of kids that fall through the cracks. So, but that's a step you can take. That's probably the safest thing to do, rather than trying to intervene yourself. I know as mental health professionals, medical professionals, law enforcement professionals, some of anybody dealing with children. Okay, we're required by law that if we suspect abuse to go on, that we report it.
Yeah,
okay.
Teachers as well. But the other thing is, you know, as parents, we need to be aware of where our kids are going online, and we have a way to report that kind of thing too. Again, it's on the same page I'm talking to you about. It's the cyber tip line, which you can contact them and say, I'm suspecting that there's such and such a person out there who uses a certain screen name who is really a predator. They'll take it from there. But it's up to us as a community to do the reporting, you know, because otherwise, you know, law enforcement does depend on the community to come forward with the tip, you know, with the suggestion, with the hint. And if it makes you feel uncomfortable, I say, as a community policing person, I say, report it. Because law enforcement would rather follow up on a tip that turns out to go nowhere than not receive a tip that ends up with a child being molested or a domestic violence situation or whatever it is. So,
hey, you know what? I started the show, Bill. I wanted to add this. I started the show with Bill and Jessica telling their stories because I want folks to understand just how important it is to intervene in a situation. The impact of this is just something that impacts a person's life for the rest of their lives, and you, as an adult, do have an opportunity to do something positive for someone, even in a situation where you're concerned that you might be wrong. You know, I worked in an employment situation where we talked about people reporting misconduct in the workplace, and they found that the number one reason that people didn't come forward was because they were concerned about a loss of relationship. They were concerned that they would make somebody angry by coming forward. And I think that concern can transfer into this situation where you're dealing with your neighbors or with the parents of children who are classmates of your own children and so forth, where you're angry that you – I'm sorry, where you are concerned that if you say something and bring something forward, they're going to become angry with you. And that it might be important to think about how your concern about them being angry is perhaps not as important as the positive impact that you can have on a child's life by helping them to be brought out of a situation where they're being abused. Dr. Jay, could you speak on that, please?
Well, I mean, like I said, if they report to an abuse hotline, okay, they can do it anonymously so that you know the people don't even know who it is that called. So they don't have to worry about their neighbors being mad. I would prefer having my neighbor be angry with me, okay, and be wrong, than to have suspicions and report it, and you know and not do it, and find out that I was right.
Right.
I agree with you 100%. I'd rather lose a neighbor and save a child.
Let me give you another statistic you're going to be wowed by. Every 10 seconds in our country, there is one of these calls made to some hotline or some child abuse system every 10 seconds. Every 3 seconds, a child goes missing in our country. And 1/4 of them go missing at the hands of strangers. This is epidemic in proportion, as you said, you so happily said earlier in the show. That is exactly the word that I use. And until we get the education out there, until we get these numbers out there, people don't understand the size of the problem. Yeah, we know we have a problem. We see the story in the newspaper or on our local news, but it drowns out the 25 others that are right behind it that never get a drop of ink or a second of airtime. And this is why it's so important that we really do understand the scope of the problem.
The problem, right. Bill, so you note that it is such a huge problem. It is happening much more than I think people really want to, if people want to recognize, but it's, you know, totally unacceptable. And Jessica, your phrase there I think was really apt. I'd rather lose a neighbor and save a child.
Yes,
you know, so our priorities are really important for us.
In a heartbeat.
Our priorities. Right, right.
I get involved a lot in my community, and I do take the time to get to know my children around this community. I have to be somebody's child's ears and eyes and voice. That's the way I look at it.
Way back in the olden days, we couldn't get away with anything as kids because every parent knew every kid in the neighborhood. And, you know, before we got home, they would call our parents and tell us what we did. We knew that was going to happen. That's not the case today.
Yes.
This is
nowadays. Yes.
Nowadays, you know, we don't pay attention the way we need to, and it does. You know, I always say everybody's child is everybody's child. We have a responsibility for every kid in the world. You know, and something, we can do something, you know, if we admit it to ourselves, something, even if it's small, that adds to the mix of people doing positive things that raise the community rather than keep the fences up between us, you know, so that we become real neighbors to each other. I mean, Jessica's a great example. She skipped a 20-year period of time in there where she neglected to tell you about how wonderful her boys are, and I tried to say that briefly. But she's also neglected to tell you that she's involved with her own Crime Watch, you know, community. She's a coordinator of her neighborhood watch captains and so forth. She puts herself out, and she's very involved and engaged. So this is another thing that she does, you know, that just a contribution she can make to try to keep the streets safe and improve the quality of life.
Well, thank you, Bill.
Kudos to you for all of the efforts that you're putting into doing what you do, and of course, doing it in the backdrop of being a survivor yourself. So, you know, it is amazing and wonderful and important that you are coming out and informing people and encouraging people to do the right thing where this is concerned. I know in the United States we have something of a tension between our values for privacy and autonomy and self-determination on the one hand, and on the other hand, the need to sometimes feel okay sticking your nose into other people's business, especially where the welfare of a child is involved.
I do it in a nice way.
Well, yes, and so there are ways to do it. And it's important to remember that. We're coming down toward the end of the show, actually. It's amazing how time has flown. I want us to talk about something that has been touched on a bit, and I think it might have been Bill or Dr. J. You talked about the Internet, about the ways in which predators or sex offenders reach out to children. I know that the convention is sort of, you know, child walking to school and the bad man in the car drives by and says, can you help me find my puppy? How often is it that's the situation versus a situation where it is a relative or a close friend, somebody that you yourself have allowed to come into your own home?
Well, this would be the last set of statistics. I don't want to bore people with statistics, but it is a group that I usually say on the air. As I said earlier, 90% of people that are abused, it happens by someone they know, love, or trust. But within that group, are the group of people that kids who go online think they can trust. 1 in 7 children who go online do receive sexual solicitations, by the way. 1 in 3 of them is exposed to unwanted sexual material. And fully 1 in 25 gets a request to meet somebody that they've only met online, but they've come to trust, to meet somebody in real life, 1 in 25. And what that means is that a lot of these kids, you know, there's a whole other part of the world, the virtual world, that we have to protect our kids about and understand that, you know, people can be who they want to be online. And our children, when you're a 13-year-old girl, you're very flattered that some 25-year-old guy is paying attention to you. At least that's what he tells you he is. And, you know, you will be likely to come to trust him and maybe even meet him. And unfortunately, the statistics are that 500 kids a day go missing in our country at the hands of people who are non-family members. 500 a day. We don't have any idea of the statistics. And that includes people they think they know, they've met online. It also includes being picked up off the street or off your front yard, of course. But of that number, you know, the vast majority are abducted by a stranger who kills them, holds them for ransom, or intends to keep them, and that's very rare. It does happen. And so we have to act quickly because, according to the Department of Justice, the final figure I'll tell you tonight is 74% of the kids who were abducted and later murdered, they were found murdered within 3 hours of being taken. They were killed within 3 hours. So that's why our Amber Alert systems are so important, and the system that we advise people to sign up for at achildismissing.org, which takes advantage of cell phone technology and email addresses to let you know if something's happening in your immediate neighborhood, achildismissing.org. That's why these things are so important. The speed with which we can come to terms with a child that's gone, maybe know what they look like or the circumstances, can make all the difference in the world, obviously.
Right. So it sounds like you're saying that there is a mix. You know, you said that 500 children a day are a stranger abduction, but then there is a large number of children who are abused by people who are friends of the family, people whom they should be able to trust, people whom you come to trust.
The statistics are that 2,000 a day are taken, but 75% of those are abducted by a family member or in a custodial dispute or something like that. So the remaining 25%, which is how I came up with 500, are stranger abductions. You know, so it's an astonishing number of kids that are at risk today, whether it's from their own family, you know, or from strangers. But obviously the stranger abductions are a very, very high priority because their intention is to use the kid, usually, and discard them, unfortunately.
And get rid of them. Right, yeah. Well, on that note, we're, you know, coming down toward the end of the show. I want to be able to recap what we've heard so that parents can, you know, walk away with concrete information to be helpful. What I think is most important, then, is just having an open relationship with your children, making sure that they can come to you with any question and not feel embarrassed about it. And that requires parents becoming comfortable talking about sex with their children, talking about healthy sexuality. And it may mean reaching out to some of the resources that we mentioned online, and then also, as Jessica mentioned, going to the library and finding books that are available there so that parents can develop a skill set that allows them to talk with their children about sex and to be able to model healthy relationships within their own homes. One of the things that I'm also getting is that it's not easy or possible, perhaps, to predict what questions your children are going to have and when they're going to have them, that it's an organic process. You know, we can't sit here and bullet point for you necessarily step one, step two, and step three regarding particular children. I know that Planned Parenthood was mentioned and that there is a guide there that is divided up by age so that parents can have a better idea of what might an age-appropriate conversation be like. But each child is different and is going to have different concerns. So the best way, it sounds like, the best way to educate your children and have them be less likely to become victims is for you to be available to them as a resource. So that's what I'm hearing. And if you folks have any last moments, we have about 3 minutes left in the show, so I'm going to have to ask you to be very brief. But I do want to give an opportunity. Oh, before I do that, I want to thank our caller. I didn't get a chance to do that. But thank you so much to our caller for calling in and asking some wonderful questions that kept the conversation going. But in the last moments of the show, if you could wrap things up for me, and you know, I thank you for being my guest today.
Well, thank you for having us. And I think you wrapped it up very, very well.
Great. Thank you, Dr. J. Bill?
Yeah, I do too. And somebody in the chat room thanked us for, they called us an asset to society and wished more people would stand up to the cause. That's what we hope too, you know. And for that purpose, we do have the website that we mentioned before, the Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. I typed it in the chat room, but it's NASCA.org, NAASCA.org. It gives a lot of information about all the things we talked about tonight. At least as a beginning, you know, a good beginning, a good solid beginning. Plus, of course, we do our shows that are always on this topic, 6 times a week, and they can look up the show information by going to blogtalkradio.com/Bill-Murray, Bill-Murray, and it'll give them all the times of our shows, which are Monday to Friday, basically, for an hour at 8, and Sunday tonight, we'll be back on the air in an hour from now, with a 2-hour show, and Dr. J will be joining us for that show too. So this is our whole purpose, and it's our privilege. My response in the room was, it's our privilege and pleasure to be able to do this kind of work. It's what we want to do. We don't want any child to go through what we went through ever again, if possible, or any family to go through what our families went through, you know, and so we're willing to do whatever that takes.
Thank you so much, Bill. We've got about 20 seconds left. Jessica, I'd like to let you wrap things up.
Well, I want to thank you very much and just tell your listeners to don't hesitate to talk to your children. Start building a communication, a great solid foundation for your kids at a very early age.
Wonderful. Thank you all so very much for joining us. And thank you, listeners, for joining in. I hope that you've enjoyed the show today and learned more about it. Use the resources that are available. Contact me at info@123untangled.com or visit my website at www.123untangled.com if you'd like more information or how to follow up with Bill or Jessica or Dr. J. You've been listening to The Problem is the Answer, a show brought to you by Entangled Resolutions, a private practice in relationship coaching and divorce mediation. Feel free to contact us, and I hope you have a wonderful week, everyone. Enjoy the rest of your day. You're going to be hearing a little from Michelle Webb as we finish out the show.